You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 2nd of May 2014 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, Nigeria continues to investigate a car bombing in the capital Abuja last night that left 19 people dead and more than 60 injured. We'll assess the deteriorating situation in the country with James Schneider, editor of Think Africa Press, and the author Ben Judah. Also coming up...
Our city is under attack. I'd ask the children, women and pensioners to leave their homes. Men who have arms to assist in any possible way. We will defend our city. We will win.
A video message from the eastern Ukrainian town of Slovyansk is released, calling for armed opposition to the Kiev government's attempts to reclaim the territory as Ukraine's descent into chaos continues. And a little later in the programme, Greece's media landscape is only partly free. That's according to a new report on press freedom around the world, published today. We'll hear the reaction from Athens.
Any ordinary Greek you speak to, he will be very suspicious of the media in the country because they're usually owned by big businessmen who use them to promote their own interests.
And before the end of the programme...
It was the jewel of our empire.
People of Pompeii! Let the games begin!
We'll bring you our weekly review of the latest releases at the box office. That and more besides, all to come here on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So lots coming up in the next hour here on Midori House. But before all that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news.
The US Secretary of State John Kerry said today that South Sudan's president has expressed his commitment to end 4 months of fighting and enter talks on a transitional government after warning that the increasingly ethnic violence in Africa's youngest nation could descend into genocide. Kerry's trip to South Sudan to meet President Salva Kiir, his first visit to Juba as Secretary of State, came a day after he renewed US threats of sanctions. He said his meeting with Salva Kiir was very frank.
Throughout the meeting, I made it clear to him that he needs to do everything in his power to end the violence and also to begin a process of national dialogue, a process by which there is the beginning of discussions, real discussions, about a transition government that can bring peace to the country.
The U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel has said that NATO's European members need to increase their defense spending in light of Russia's action in Ukraine. The level of defense spending by NATO allies has been a long-standing concern of U.S. defense secretaries. Only a handful of the 28 countries actually spend 2% of their GDP on defense, as agreed under the NATO partnership. Russia's recent incursion into Ukraine has rekindled concerns among NATO allies. On Friday, today, pro-Russian rebels shot down two Ukrainian helicopters, killing two people as Ukrainian forces tightened their siege of the separatist-held East Ukrainian city of Slavyansk. In the Midwest of the United States, prosecutors say police in Waseca, Minnesota, probably stopped a planned school massacre when they arrested a teenager, 17-year-old John David Ladue, in connection with the March discovery of explosive devices on the grounds of a local elementary school. Waseca Superintendent Tom Lee said a horrific experience was avoided because of the vigilance of the local community and the police.
The members of the Waseca Public Schools community are deeply saddened and disturbed at the arrest of one of our students. The information that has been revealed indicates that we have escaped what could have been a horrific experience. We can either believe that this occurred as a result of a lucky break, or, as I do, choose to believe that God was looking out for all of us.
Heavily armed tribal guerrillas raided a village in northeastern India on Friday and killed 11 Muslim settlers in a further attack linked to an upsurge in ethnic tensions during a drawn-out general election. Nine of the dead were women and children in the attack in the tea-growing state of Assam, hours after two similar attacks there in which 11 people, all of them Muslims, were killed. Here, the British Library previewed its latest exhibition to the world of comic books, hoping to celebrate the impact British comic book artists and writers have had on the international scene. Adrian Edwards is the museum's lead curator of printed historical sources.
What we want to do is show that comics are a valuable resource for understanding Britain, its society in past decades and centuries. So for us, it's important to do it. But yeah, people are surprised. But the British Library is not a staid organisation. We've got lots of... We do interesting things. We're very interested in putting creative artists in contact with our collections, helping inspire the creative industries, and this fits with that agenda, absolutely.
And finally, state media in China say a Beijing man is seeking to divorce his wife after she took their son, to a Chinese tropical island to escape the capital's notorious smog. He said the long-distance relationship had destroyed their marriage. The man called Wang married his wife in 2008 and had that son 2 years later. And that's latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. You're listening to Midoriya House here on Monocle 24, and we're going to be right back after this.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
位于伦敦, 这是 Monocle 24.
Outlondo, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, London.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midoriya House, and the time here is 18.06 in London, which means it's 13.06 in New York. Now, joining me with their take on the news here in the studio is James Schneider, editor of Think Africa Press, and Ben Judah, author of Fragile Empire, How Russia Fell In and Out of Love with Vladimir Putin. Welcome both to the programme. Now, we're going to start in Nigeria and the capital, Abuja, where a car bomb last night has left at least 19 dead and dozens injured. The blast happened close to the site of last month's bomb attack on a bus station that cost at least 70 people their lives. Responsibility for that attack was taken by the Islamist group Boko Haram. This comes against the backdrop of the kidnap last month of more than 200 schoolgirls who are still missing somewhere in Borno State. It's believed that Boko Haram, which means Western education is forbidden in the local dialect, are behind the abductions. James, let's start with you. What's happening here?
Nigeria is facing an enormous crisis, and it's getting worse. And it's come in, and it's a change of tactics beforehand. Boko Haram has, for pretty much all of its insurgency since 2009, has mainly been targeting state installations. It attacks police stations, military barracks. It's attacked the odd media institution, and it attacks prisons and occasionally traditional leaders. Now, because of the change in policy within the northeast of Nigeria, so now the population themselves are rising up, and they've created these what's called civilian joint task force, who are basically self-defense units protecting themselves from Boko Haram attacks. Boko Haram have decided that ordinary civilians are now part of the enemy and they're now part of the state, which is why there's been this spate of attacks on villages and attacks on schools in the northeast of the country. Now, coupled with that, there's been this shift. They attacked Abuja beforehand. They were pushing south when they were stronger, but they haven't attacked the capital now for nearly 3 years, until the attack on the 14th of April. And this change of strategy shows that I think they're more interested in violence and impact and sowing discord rather than specifically attacking targets. Beforehand, when they issued a statement after a particular attack, they would say, this is in response to something specific. So we are attacking this prison because these people who are part of us are in this particular prison. Now it has moved onwards, and Abubakar Shekau, who is the leader of Boko Haram, has released a video in which he has the rather blood-curdling line, we're about killing, killing, killing and killing. So what we have is a organisation which, whilst in many ways on the back foot, has turned out to be even more violent than it was beforehand. And this poses a real threat to Goodluck Jonathan's administration, because not only has he been seen to be pretty absent in these 234 schoolgirls who've been kidnapped, and there've been mass protests on the streets of Abuja saying, bring back our girls, they have to be found. But also, he's got the World Economic Forum on Africa is in Abuja, and it's next week. And there's been these two bomb blasts in the exactly the same place, and there's been heightened security where in the bus station and around that area where where the bomb blast was last month, and there's been another one again. So it's striking, it's undermining confidence in the Goodluck Jonathan administration's ability to respond to this new possible new phase of Boko Haram violence.
But, Ben, you wanted to come in.
I'd be interested to know what I hear when I speak to Nigerians in Britain, and you speak to them, is that because of Nollywood and the boom in the Nigerian economy, for the first time coming out of Nigeria is a positive image of Black Africa created by Black Africans for Black Africans in films, in movies, in music. And the story of the last 10 years has also been about that of the rise of Africa, and there's increasing interest of returning to Nigeria for business. Do you think that the Boko Haram insurgency can destroy that?
Not really, no, because the Boko Haram insurgency comes out of a part of the country which is already rather removed from this cultural expansion as we've seen in Nollywood and any kind of rising GDP growth or kind of cultural dominance. Because this part of the country, this northeast, is both linguistically distinct and it's also, you know, very underdeveloped. So whilst it's undermines the narrative somewhat and it does cause tensions and worries, the fact that it's mainly isolated to this area means that the rest of the narrative does continue.
So it's still a tale of two Nigerias.
Yeah, absolutely.
Ben, I wanted to ask you though, obviously, you know, Boko Haram does have support, and that support comes from what? Is that fed by just Islamism? Is it fed by what is economically happening in Nigeria, a part of the country that feels left out of what's happening? Why do they appear to be so strong?
Well, their support actually looks like it's on the wane quite significantly, at least in the population, because they've turned against the population. It came out of being a social movement, which, I mean, the highest estimate, don't know if this is true, but the highest estimate was 200,000 followers. This is before the violent turn in 2009, after their leader was killed by the police. But now there is evidence that they are hiring basically mercenaries from across the border in Niger, who are basically smuggling gangs, who they're paying to come to join them as fighters. So it looks like whilst they are being quite high profile and very violent and killing a lot of people, that actually their capacity to recruit people is decreasing. And some of the kidnappings that are taking place are linked to forcing people into the movement, whilst beforehand it would be more easy to recruit people.
Ben, there's been a suggestion that actually Western governments may lend aircraft and support to kind of track down these schoolgirls. But that's a kind of a murky step, isn't it? Because suddenly you can quite quickly find yourself caught up with Boko Haram on the ground.
What's very interesting about relating to Nigeria now, that I don't think is going to be the case in 10 years and definitely not in 20 years, is it's not seen as a deeply emotional crisis. The British government doesn't think that the crisis in Nigeria is one that's going to affect how it's seen at home or how it's seen by the kind of intelligentsia in the media, say, compared to the crisis in Ukraine, which it fears can tarnish its image. What I find so interesting is actually just how connected to Nigeria Britain actually is. The Nigerian population of Britain is likely over 1 million people. The Nigerian community estimates it's over 2 million. It's an extremely young community. And you have, in the 15 to 20-year-old bracket in London, a real heavy sense of a kind of Nigerian presence on YouTube, in music. And I think that when crises in Nigeria happen in 10 years' time, 15 years' time, we're going to feel that they're crises that Britain is very involved with. And it's a very little-known fact that the majority of Black British people are of actually African background, and the majority of those are of Nigerian background.
James?
There is a risk. I mean, I don't think that the kind of security partners to Nigeria, mainly Britain and the US, can say, right, we're not going to be involved at all. But the way in which the Nigerian military and police have operated over the last 5 years have been one of the drivers of this conflict. So the violent turn for Boko Haram came when 1,000 members were arrested and their leader was killed by the police. Also, there was an Amnesty International report out last year that said that 1,000 since the emergency rule and the new joint task force operation had started in the northeast, that 1,000 people had died in custody after mass arrests. So the Nigerian government does not have a kind of proud record of being discriminate in its arrests and in its killings in response to Boko Haram. So there is a risk of guilt by association by Western partners, but that should just lead them to try to engage also in the training and also providing funding for judicial capabilities in the north of the country, as well as just helping with aircraft and military training.
Well, we're going to take a pause there. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, James Schneider, editor of Think Africa Press, and Ben Judah, the author of Fragile Empire. When we return, we'll assess the deteriorating situation in Ukraine.
On the Foreign Desk this week, we look back 40 years to Portugal's Carnation Revolution.
When my wife told me that there had been a coup in Portugal, my question was in favour or against.
Four decades since dictatorship gave way to democracy, we'll ask what the revolution means to the country today.
I think it's important to realise how dramatically impoverished the dictatorship had left Portugal, and how, relatively speaking, the quality of life changed dramatically.
And as Portugal continues to grapple with its economic crisis, how bright is the country's future?
Europe is in a very difficult position, and we should also change not only Portugal, because we can't change only Portugal. We must change Europe too.
That's Revolution Portugal, this week's edition of The Foreign Desk on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Monocle 24 and Midori House. Still with me is James Schneider, editor of Think Africa Press, and Ben Judah, author of Fragile Empire. Let's head to Ukraine now, where the situation in the east of the country has escalated dramatically in the past 24 hours. Two Ukrainian military helicopters were shot down late yesterday by members of the pro-Russian opposition in the city of Slovyansk. As Ukrainian forces continued the operations in the area, a video emerged from Slovyansk in which a self-proclaimed de facto member of the town gave this message to the people living there.
Dear Slavyansk residents, I want to address you with a statement that our city is under attack, that our city is being stormed, that we already have casualties. I'd ask the children, women and pensioners to leave their homes, men who have arms to assist in any possible way. We will defend our city. Thank you for your attention. Thank you for your help. We will win.
Well, shortly after that video was released, local reports claimed that two Ukrainian soldiers and a pro-Russian fighter were killed in a standoff in the city. The international community continues to work towards a response to the crisis. First thing this morning, earlier today, the EU's representative on foreign affairs, Catherine Ashton, gave this statement on the escalating crisis.
It is absolutely vital that we do not see continuing violence. It's absolutely vital that we see occupations of buildings reduced. It is absolutely vital, as I have said to everyone, that we see the functioning of the Rada, the Parliament, as being the place where all representatives of Ukraine can work together.
That was Catherine Ashton, the EU's representative on foreign affairs, speaking a little earlier. Ben, we keep coming to tipping points. Is this another point at which there is actually kind of no way back from it? It does seem that the east of the country, as we've seen, even the government in Kiev admits it's kind of completely out of its control now.
Well, I think it's absolutely vital that we understand that in Ukraine, the dream of the European Union being an effective foreign policy superpower in its own backyard has been buried. Throughout this whole crisis, which began with a revolution in Kiev and across Western Ukraine in support of the EU, draped in the EU flag, the bloc has become progressively discredited, and by being unable to impose sanctions, unable to influence the situation. And Catherine Ashton is now a term of abuse in Ukraine. And her statements, of which always begin with grave concern, has also entered the Ukrainian lexicon as a term of abuse. There's been a major Western casualty to this already. Looking at what's happening, I think the most important thing to say is that yesterday Vladimir Putin ordered the Ukrainian military to withdraw from eastern Ukraine, which of course is Ukraine and Ukrainian sovereign territory. And Ukraine has not responded by this and has tried to launch military operations. They've gone very badly. They're very feeble. It's very badly organized. And they're not going very well. Russian, pro-Russian forces and have, in response, started to foment instability in Odessa. And the crisis is spreading into southern Ukraine. And there's currently street fighting. There are three casualties in Odessa. And there are clashes between a pro-Russian group which has taken over the administrative headquarters, which in these pro-Russian movements has been the first step towards declaring self-proclaimed autonomies. And there are clashes around a Russian protest camp in central Odessa.
But Ben, while the Russians may be very successful at kind of, you know, getting this kind of fermenting, you know, kind of trouble in the east, there isn't really a kind of clear game plan of what they want. Is that they don't particularly want to kind of send their troops across the border and find themselves mired in fighting for months to come. They don't want to kind of find themselves caught up in even more sanctions. They've kind of got the bit of, you know, in a way, precisely, of Ukraine they want. So what's the script here?
The Russian foreign minister doesn't know what the script is. Speak to Russian diplomats, they don't know what's going on. Speak to individuals close to the Russian administration, they don't know what's going on. Speak to senators in Moscow, they don't know what's going on. Only Putin, a tiny circle of individuals around him, are setting the agenda. And there's a lot of fear in the wider Russian elite about how closed off and unpredictable they've become. So what the Russian foreign ministry and my sources there have been telling me over the past few months is that only Putin is the one in charge of the situation, and people don't know how far he's willing to go in the name of his destiny, in the name of his vision of himself, how romantic and unhinged from reality he's become. It's important to say that even former members of Putin's administration who've now gone into business can't get a meeting with him.
James, as you watch this unfolding situation, not quite your territory normally, you're an African man, but there are as many things happening here which, you know, are duplicated around the world. This is, you know, the collapse of a country. This is, you know, neighbours eyeing up the prize. What do you make of the situation as you see it?
Well, I think I would entirely agree with Ben that I've never heard Catherine Ashton say anything that wasn't platitudinous in the extreme. And at the moment, the African continent is being blessed by the presence of John Kerry walking around saying exactly the same thing. But I think that looking at the European response to the crisis, it's been pretty flawed because it's been based on, in some ways, stoking up domestic confrontation whilst being internationally kind of standoffish and not really willing to fully confront Vladimir Putin, which seems to me to be exactly the wrong way around. It seems to be you would want to be trying to promote as much coming together within the country as possible whilst being able to beat the Russian regime.
But it is a kind of impossible situation, isn't it? Because if we take more effective action as Europeans, as Western Europeans, then we damage our own economies, and everybody's trying to drag themselves out of recession. They don't want to do that. They don't want to kind of provoke, you know, Putin anymore.
I do think it sort of depends what the sanctions are and how you and how you do it, and then what their response is. I mean, there are some sanctions that we could do which would actually be rather beneficial, I think, probably to the Russian economy, which would be shutting down crony banks branches here, which are only used to funnel out money from Russia illicitly, which is committing fraud in two countries.
But in a way, Africa's a good example, you know, of how sanctions work. You know, one, Zimbabwe, and two, South Africa. Yes, they were hurt by them, but they both ticked along, and actually people dug in even further and thought, to hell with you, we're going to carry on as we want, and you're not going to change our minds.
Putin's position.
Yes, that's true. But there are, I mean, sanctions aren't sanctions. They're very different. The sanctions against Zimbabwe are rather different to the sanctions that there were against South Africa, and they had a different purpose. And you could have an entirely different set of formulation of sanctions against Russia. I mean, sanctions in some cases are absolutely disastrous. Take Cuba or Iraq, but in some cases, sanctions, if they're well targeted and well planned out, can work.
I think it's very important over the next month that a serious signal is sent to the Russian establishment that these ministers and police chiefs and oil company barons who've been ruling with authoritarianism at home and enjoying the proceeds of globalization abroad start to feel that there is a cost for the politics of adventurism and expansionism. And the big test is going to be the St. Petersburg Economic Forum, which takes place at the end of May. And here you will have the Russian elite, thus the entire EU and US sanctions list, that will be hosting European and American CEOs. The White House said it would be inappropriate for American CEOs to go, but quickly glancing at the list of those who plan to attend before coming out, I saw that the CEOs of Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, Bain Consulting, the Boston Consulting Group, are all planning to be there. So if the West is willing to send a signal that really the businessmen that rule Russia are going to become isolated and suffer, they need to tighten their sanctions list to make it so that Western businessmen can't meet Russians on the sanctions list, such as Igor Sechin, in the context of a business forum. Otherwise, these sanctions are going to look kind of cosmetic and designed not to lose face on the BBC or on sort of NBC, far more than actually having a kind of strategic point to them.
Well, let's have a look at a slightly different story. Actually, there's a bit of connection. We've just seen Vladimir Putin do one of his marathon TV Q&A sessions. Well, the King of Saudi Arabia, he's got an idea about how to speak to his people and get more connected. He set up a website where you can email a question and he promises to reply. Well, that's what he says. Anyway, when we look at this, James, the attempt by leaders to be connected with their people, or to at least give the appearance of being connected with their people, any good examples? Do you think it's an effective thing to use social media to connect with your people?
Well, it's interesting to see because many leaders across the African continent have started taking this up, and you can really tell very easily the ones that do it themselves that will probably be sitting a bit bored in a meeting and they'll be on Twitter, and the ones that don't. And the ones that don't, I think, provide no benefit whatsoever to, if it's their staff who's doing it, it provides very little benefit to either the politician or really the population. But there are some notable examples of those who actually manage their own accounts. And one of them, the Ugandan Prime Minister, Amani Babazi, is statistically will respond to tweets the most of any global politician. There was some study done by some board researchers at a Swedish university. And it's true. I tried it out. I sort of messaged him about something, and he's got like a 97% response rate. It can turn slightly nasty, however. So Paul Kagame, the Rwandan president, is well known for being on Twitter. And sometimes he is approachable and he'll respond to things, and sometimes he'll issue kind of statements on there and go on slightly interesting rants. But it is also tied into a strategy of using kind of dummy accounts. People who engage with him in a way that he doesn't like, then the different dummy accounts are set up to then go and attack them and troll them on Twitter.
Ben, I gave the example of Vladimir Putin's massive Q&A sessions. When you look at other leaders and how they use, the idea of being open to the public, what's your thoughts?
I think that most of these leaders' accounts, where you can kind of message them or ping them, just end up being giant repositories for online abuse. So if you... But I just clicked on one of David Cameron's tweets, which was, check out what Ed Pickles is doing about housing. And all of the responses to him were things like, nothing, get lost, never vote for you, mate, moon face. Repeated the experiment by clicking on Ed Miliband's recent tweets, which was, I'm in Barnsley meeting crucial frontline sector workers, and a lot of expletives underneath, no you're not, get lost, leave Barnsley alone. And Putin set up a kind of an account where you could kind of message him. And it became, again, a giant repository of abuse, strange photos,
It's old school hustings, isn't it, with tomatoes being thrown.
These are kind of a little bit gimmicky. And you have... Mr. Abdullah is extremely old. So I'm going to be very interested if he actually... I'd be very interested if he's actually sort of aware of a lot of the aspects of social media. And what this smacks of is... I can't remember his precise age. I believe... James, is he in his 80s?
He's pretty old.
But 80s or 90s? Well, I'm... But, well,
some 80-year-olds are good on social media. We mustn't be too judging.
What I think is happening at King Abdullah is that...
He says carefully.
I suspect that he's being persuaded into a gimmick by some
very
young,
well-paid Western PR
agency. Quite possibly, yes. Looking at kind of Putin's approach to Russia's citizens, Putin's approach is actually remarkably old-fashioned, which is you go out... And you just talk and talk and talk. And Putin is incredibly busy. Like, Putin's weekly routine involves... You know, he doesn't wake up before midday, of course. But he goes to three different Russian cities a week. He has endless meetings where he's out there. And setting up a social media account or, like, tweeting about what Ed Pickles is doing for housing, I don't think that's a match for Putin's kind of on-the-ground presence.
Have you seen what's happening in Crimea, hashtag?
Yeah, well...
we're going to leave it there before it goes off the rails. Well, that was James Schneider, who's the editor of Think Africa Press, and Ben Judah, author of Fragile Empire, How Russia Fell In and Out of Love with Vladimir Putin. Thank you both very much for joining us. And...
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Well, plenty still to come in the second half of Midori House, including...
It's me. By my count, that's two of yours and two of mine. I don't know how this ends.
That's how this works, man. The one with the gun gets to tell the truth.
Well, we're going to review the latest movie releases with the film critic Tim Robey. But before we get started on that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the latest world news headlines.
Thank you very much. Heavily armed tribal guerrillas have raided a village in northeastern India today and killed 11 Muslim settlers in a further attack linked to an upsurge in ethnic tensions during a drawn-out general election there. The US Secretary of State John Kerry said today that South Sudan's president has expressed his commitment to end 4 months of fighting and enter talks on a transitional government after warning that the increasingly ethnic violence in Africa's youngest nation could descend into genocide. The US Defence Secretary Chuck Hagel has said that NATO's European members need to increase their defence spending in light of Russia's actions in Ukraine. Russia's recent incursions into Ukraine has rekindled concerns among NATO allies. And in the Midwest of the US, prosecutors say police in Waseca in Minnesota probably stopped a planned school massacre when they arrested a teenager in connection with the March discovery of explosive devices on the grounds of a local elementary school. And that's the latest news here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. And Jonathan will be back in another 30 minutes with a full roundup of today's news. But welcome back to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. Time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today, we head to Greece to talk to our Athens correspondent, Natalie Savarakis. Natalie, thank you for coming on the show. Let's start with quite a serious report that's come out, which is about press freedom. Greece has fallen further than any other country on the chart this year. Why is that?
Well, first, it started mainly because the authorities, the government, last year in June, shut down the state broadcaster, ERT, which was a very controversial move. It drew international condemnation and criticism. And the government defended its point by saying that it had to cut costs and anyways, it said that ERT didn't actually, couldn't compare itself, if you like, with the equivalent of the BBC or RAI or the French equivalents or any other ones. But of course, other organizations, including this one, didn't think that this was a decent excuse, and hence the massive drop. On another side, and a point that needs to be made, is also that in Greece, the press, I mean, any ordinary Greek you speak to, he will be very suspicious of the media in the country because they're usually owned by big entrepreneurs and businessmen who, they say, the Greeks say, use them to promote their own interests and pressure authorities and influence public opinion to their advantage. So I think all these points were taken into consideration when the drafting of this report.
I guess it's all interesting. In a way, I guess the government does have some comeback if it can claim that the closing of the TV station was to do with cost cutting. And the other problems seem to be probably endemic rather than happening now. I know there was also this interesting case where there was the whistleblower who kind of gave tax information about members of the government. And he found himself as a journalist ending up in court rather than the other way around.
Yes, indeed. There was a big controversy again about this case, where it was a big list, the Lagarde list, which was handed out to the former finance minister on tax evaders, and they failed to do much about it. The same finance minister who was handed out the case, George Papakostadinou, actually his own family was named in that list, which many say that that was probably the reason why he failed to do much about it. But even his successors didn't do much about it. And of course, the authorities were quick to take him to court for violating privacy laws, etc., because in his list, in his articles, he also included names of people who didn't actually even have 1 cent in their accounts. And they're saying he's exposing unnecessarily people who, you know, probably weren't even tax evading. So all these issues, of course, need to be considered in a country like Greece. And of course, going to any protest, what's interesting to notice is also the heavy-handed approach that the police has against protesters and especially against the press who's been there to photograph and record the protest.
Now let's look at a brighter spot for Greece, and that's tourism. There's a really interesting launch of a seaplane company which is going to try and connect some of the islands with a scheduled service. And just looking at some of the information, it's quite interesting. It's only going to cost, I think, roughly about 82 euros per flight each way. But why is this important, do you think?
Tourism is, without a doubt, the motor of the Greek economy. It's a way, if you like, to attract and accommodate the high-end tourism. Greece has 3,000 islands, islets, and big rocks. Out of those, 200 are inhabited. So it's another way, if you like, to connect all these islands and to make it possible for people to move around and not to be glued to the ferry schedules or their own private yachts. Now, these, of course, are small planes. They're trying to make them affordable to the ordinary public, and they're hoping to launch this by August.
Do we know where they're going to be flying between yet? Have they announced their kind of routes?
Yes, there will be islands of the Sporades. One of these islands that might be known to the international audience is Skopelos, which was the setting of the Mamma Mia movie a few years ago. So they're going to start with these islands and then slowly expand to other cluster of islands throughout the Aegean.
And finally, staying slightly on the tourism theme, there's a new series of walks, of all things, being introduced. Tell me why this is of interest to us.
As we know, Greece has a very rich history and culture dating back thousands of years. Now, Greeks lack, if you like, an awareness of environment and nature. And what the authorities have tried to do now is to make it more interesting to people to walk through, if you like, cities throughout the country, introduce them to their heritage culturally and historically, but also introduce them to nature. For example, in Athens, a river that no longer exists, Eridanos, they will walk through where it used to flow in Athens. They will teach students to plant all these flowers and herbs that were used back in ancient times to heal patients. And it's just a very novel idea for Greeks to be again proud and understand their heritage and combine it with the environment and nature.
So you heard it here first. Pack your boots and your bikini if you're heading to Greece this summer. Natalie, as ever, thank you very much for joining us. That was Natalie Savarakos, who's, of course, our woman in Athens. Up next, we're going to discuss philosophy and also review this week's film releases. Stay tuned to find out more on this episode of Midori House here on Monocle 24.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on the shows you might have missed. You can download programs to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders for all your favourites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants, and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favourites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Instapaper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. The Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Well, we were going to do philosophy now, but we're not. We can't find our philosophy editor, even if I can say it, author rather, hopefully having some big thoughts somewhere. But anyway, welcome back to Midori House. It's 40 years since Portugal's Carnation Revolution swept the dictatorship of Estado Novo from power and installed democracy in the country. In this week's edition of The Foreign Desk, Monocle's foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, chairs a discussion on the legacy of the revolution in the context of ongoing economic uncertainty in the country. In this excerpt from the programme, the journalist Nelson Ribeiro looks back at the beginning of the revolution and to the uprising's rather unusual starting gong, a song from the Eurovision Song Contest.
So, Portugal now.
The revolution in April 74, it has two songs that are very much associated with the revolution because they were both used as signals so that the military would know that the operation was to go ahead. The first one, which is not the most known one, is a song by a Portuguese artist, Paulo de Carvalho, and it is called E Depois do Adeus, which was aired on a radio station operating in Lisbon, but this radio station did not have national coverage. This meant, of course, that it was used to signal the revolution, but it was mostly listened to by the military that were in the region of Lisbon and the nearby region. The signal that was aired around 25 minutes past midnight on the 25th of April 74 was much more complex than just the song. It included the reading of a few poems, for instance, and then the song would be played. And this song was a song by José Afonso, known as Zeca Afonso, and the song is called Grândola Vila Morena. O povo é quem mais ordena. And Zeca Afonso's music was known for expressing ideas against those that were defended by the regime, by the Portuguese dictatorship. O povo é quem mais. This particular artist, he was known because he had been producing songs since the mid-60s, and he was very much associated with those who really wished for a political change to happen in Portugal.
Para o que apelamos para o bom senso dos comandos das forças militarizadas no sentido de serem evitados quaisquer confrontos com as forças armadas.
The strategy that they had created and they went ahead with was to approach a few people that were working on radio shows that were aired on these two particular radio stations, and they told them, we are going to go ahead with the revolution, we need your help, but of course no one can know about this.
Tantos anos a estudar para acabar desempregado, ou num emprego da treta mal pago e receber uma gorjeta que chamam salário. Não tirei o curso superior de otário.
One of the biggest differences, I would say, is that while in the 70s, even the Portuguese singers that wanted to speak against the regime, they had to do that quite indirectly. Today, fortunately, that's one of the biggest conquests of the revolution in 74, is freedom of speech. Alguém me arranja emprego bom. I would say that to some extent there is really a parallel we can establish with the situation today, in the sense that the new generations, they really relate to these songs in order to come out in the public sphere and denounce the problems they are facing and the challenges they are having difficulties in overcoming.
The journalist Nelson Ribeiro there on the music that played a crucial role in Portugal's Carnation Revolution. And you can hear the full episode of The Foreign Desk tomorrow at midday London time here on Monocle 24. And I'm joined in the studio by Thomas Lewis, who is the fine producer of that show. Amazing listening to that. The power. Who would have thought that a song from Eurovision could have been so connected with the world of politics?
Exactly. And it was something. You speak to Portuguese today about those two songs that played a role in the start of the revolution, and actually the Eurovision one is internationally maybe known because it is so quirky, if you like, but actually it's the second song that really is still quite an emotive part of sort of popular protest, if you like, in Portugal today. You heard there at the end the crowd singing the second song, and that was taken from very recently, kind of amid a protest against the austerity in Portugal. But yeah, the idea that actually the soldiers were waiting secretly to hear if this Eurovision song came out, and then they knew that was the beginning of the end of the dictatorship, if you like, is still quite a magical story, I think.
And also that there is echoes today. It's fascinating that, you know, that music has still played a part for, you know, for Portuguese and how they see the country and how they protest. And I guess, you know, it's just such a rich heritage of music there.
Absolutely. And, you know, Nelson, when we were speaking after the interview, he said what's quite nice about, say, the music that started the revolution back in 74, actually, in that time, you needed lots of secret signals. If you wanted to criticise the regime, if you wanted to sort of mobilise kind of opposition, you really couldn't do that very openly. Whereas today, musicians and people who are taking to the streets in Portugal can do that openly. It can openly voice their opposition to their government and the woes they feel that are in their society. And for him, that was the greatest contrast between 74 and then the 40-year democracy that's been in Portugal ever since.
By coincidence, I had lunch today with a senior Portuguese politician, and we were discussing the country, and he was talking about how even today the legacy of that time of Salazar and of the pre-revolution still hangs over the country in many ways and still affects it. So he was giving the example in the centre of Lisbon, there's many, many empty buildings. It's because under Salazar they decided that actually you couldn't increase rents. They didn't want any market speculation at all, and these laws were so deeply rooted in Portugal that no one dared overturn them. They've only just been overturned all these years later. So in the centre of Lisbon, many buildings are empty because landlords found it cheaper to let them rot and fall down than actually rent them out to people for almost nothing. So he was saying that actually the revolution, in a way, isn't kind of finished, and that austerity was forcing the country to look at all these kind of things that had happened in Portugal.
Absolutely. And I think some of our panellists on the programme, we had Helder Macedo, who's a grand old man of Portuguese poetry. His work was censored in the 60s by Salazar. He fled to London, exile there, and then returned to Portugal immediately after the revolution. And he was saying, actually, you know, you say about things actually drip, drip, only just now kind of changing, and the hangover from that period only really sort of changing now. Well, he was saying what he felt, kind of especially with the youth in Portugal was that actually it was finding when you live in a dictatorship, you almost have something very strong that you can then form a strong opposition to. And now he said actually the economic crisis and the way he felt that, say, the European Union had dealt with Portugal and actually many of the humiliations that are dealt to the country, that now it was about kind of reimagining the democracy and reimagining the protests and the ways actually that you might be able to fight against it.
Well, Thomas, thank you very much for coming in to tell us more about your show. The Foreign Desk is on tomorrow at midday London time. Well, after that, we're not going to have a Portuguese song. We're actually going to go back to Greece. Well, we're going to have a little bit of a Greek riposte here. This, as you heard earlier, we were speaking to our Athens correspondent. This is Global, and it's by Leon, who are from Athens. That was Global by Leon from Athens, and you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and it's time now for our daily review of the arts. Today, we talk film, and I'm delighted to say that Tim Robey, a film writer at London's Daily Telegraph newspaper, joins me now. Now, we're going to start with Pompeii. I've got the description here. A slave-turned-gladiator finds himself in a race against time.
Yeah, now we're dealing with kind of like very cheesy blockbuster spectacle here. If you can imagine Gladiator meets Dante's Peak, the old kind of volcano disaster movie, meets Titanic. Basically, that's the situation. It's a disaster movie in which we're waiting about an hour and a bit for Pompeii to erupt and then most of the cast to be kind of pulverized.
Okay, well, let's have a little clip from the film.
Place of corruption, temptation.
That slave looks at you as if he's in a dream, Cassia.
And a battle. What is your name?
My name is Milo.
For survival. From all corners of the Roman world, people would gather here.
What is this?
It is the mountain.
But for all our strength.
Can you feel that?
We lived in the shadow of a greater power.
Now, you did warn me that it was a bit cheesy, but kind of fun?
Yeah, it is kind of fun in a bad movie way, basically. Okay. If you remember kind of watching The Towering Inferno on telly, you know, at Christmas as you were growing up and finding it kind of cheesily enjoyable, we're in that sort of zone. But these days, of course, the effects are on a much bigger scale. And then the last half hour, it really goes to town. I don't think the effects are actually very good in this film. They're not on the kind of on a par with something like The Day After Tomorrow, for instance, or other big disaster movie epics we've had recently. They look like they've been done slightly on the cheap, even though it was not an inexpensive film. So that detracts a little bit from your enjoyment. But you do get the kind of hammy overacting of people like Kiefer Sutherland in the cast, playing a kind of tyrannical Roman general, and that's all kind of fun.
Fun for the actors to do. But tell me, when it's a bit like Titanic, you know the ship's going to sink, you know the volcano's going to blow. Does that kind of take some of the edge off the drama?
Yeah, it does a bit. I mean, I don't know whether you felt that the love story in Titanic was kind of enough to keep you going through the hours of screen time before, you know, they hit the iceberg. But there's a certain part of you which, and a lot of the characters are kind of quite unsympathetic and very sketchily drawn, and you just sort of want the volcano to come on and erupt already because, you know.
You're thinking, I'm going to see you in a British Museum exhibition in a few hundred years' time. Now we're going to move on. Blue Ruin. What can you tell us about this?
This is an interesting little film. It's quite a low-budget American revenge thriller, and it was partly funded through Kickstarter. Basically, to get the film made, they had a certain amount of the budget, but they didn't have enough. So they turned to Kickstarter for an extra, I think, $40,000 to put it into production.
We're talking proper small budget then.
Yeah, I think the total budget was probably something like $400,000. So it's not a huge film. And in fact, there are no names in it you would necessarily know. The main actor is a guy called Macon Blair, and the director is a man called Jeremy Sonia, whose second film it is. But it's a very clever little film. It's quite reminiscent of kind of early Coen brothers when they were working on a low budget themselves, a film like Blood Simple. And it sets up this character, this kind of tramp at the beginning, who's living rough in a car. He's bearded. His life has obviously kind of fallen apart. And you realize that this is because his parents were killed 20 years before, and he's just been unable to kind of get over that. And he finds out that the man who was sent to jail for this crime has been released. And he sets about trying to kind of go and, you know, exact revenge in whatever way he can.
Well, let's hear a clip from the tramp turned assassin.
I know this is personal,
That's how you'll fail.
I'd forgive you if you were crazy. But you're not. You're weak.
Hello. It's me.
Now, I understand it's very beautifully shot, that lots of tension, that kind of, you know, edge of the seat, as the cliche runs.
It certainly is, yeah. And the interesting thing is that it's a film of very few words, particularly at the beginning. It tells its story with real visual confidence. And the fact that it was made on such a low budget, you get the sense that they've chosen every shot very carefully. They've thought it through. They've storyboarded it. Every shot has kind of weight and purpose. And then you do get quite a big dialogue scene about half an hour in, when you discover that the main character has a sister who's still alive and who has managed to kind of keep it together. She has two daughters. She's sort of living in a middle-class house, and he goes to visit her. He shaves. He puts on a nice shirt. He doesn't want to seem like he's a wreck, and they're kind of estranged. But they have this amazing scene where they sit in a diner, and he talks about what he's done, basically, with the kind of culprit. And you realize that she kind of wants the same thing that he does, you know, that grief is, in fact, kind of destroyed them from within in some ways. It's very interesting, and it kind of keeps going right to the end. Now, very compelling.
We've only got a few seconds left, but just in the last few seconds, just tell us about A Thousand Times Good Night.
This is a movie with Juliette Binoche as a war photographer. It's about the ethics of when you should stop shooting pictures when you're kind of there in Kabul. She's shooting, she's embedded with a suicide squad, and she becomes responsible. It's interesting. She's very good. I think the film is much more interested in her than it is in the conflicts that she's involved in, which is a bit of a problem. It's a little bit touristic. It goes to Kabul, it goes to Kenya. It really kind of cares mainly about her, which I thought was a bit of a limitation.
So it sounds like Blue Ruin probably gets your vote.
Blue Ruin is definitely the winner, yeah.
Tim, thank you very much for coming in to see us. That's Tim Robey, who's a film writer at the Daily Telegraph newspaper here in the UK and a regular here on Monocle 24. And that's all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guest, James Schneider, editor of Think Africa Press, and Ben Judah, author of Fragile Empire. They talked us through the ongoing crisis in Nigeria and the growing military build-up in Ukraine. Today's show was produced by Thomas Lewis, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Alexandra Stenbock-Furmore. Our studio manager was Joel Church. Next, after the headlines, is The Menu, Marcus Hippie. Then at 2200 hours, it's The Monocle Daily with Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson. This show will be back at the same time on Monday at 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Midori House, and from me, Andrew Tuck, it's just time to say goodbye and thank you for listening.
From London to Beijing,
this is Monocle 24.
Nach Amsterdam,
a Bogota,
to Hong Kong,
all around the world.
This is Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.